Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? Ew, seriously. They squeeze the grease out of the wool and process it with chemicals, and then you eat it. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I got rid of products I didn't want anywhere near my body. I found that many multivitamins contain high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and even lacked some of the nutrients we actually needed. So what did I do? At 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. Ritual's products are made traceable, meaning we share the science and sourcing for every single ingredient. For example, our vegan vitamin D3 comes from sustainably harvested lichen in Nottingham, England, not sheep. We trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. See for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Before we get started, we'd like to tell y'all about a podcast, one of my absolute favorites. It's called Vanishing Postcards. So far, Vanishing Postcards has told the stories of several Texas dives and attractions off the beaten path, from the Black Cowboy Museum in Rosenberg to Arky Blue's Silver Dollar down in Bandera. The podcast is full of local lore, Texas colloquialisms, and even a little cowboy poetry from the inimitable Hoot Gibson. I can't recommend Vanishing Postcards enough. Here's a trailer.
18 or 80, crippled, blind, or crazy, I'm going dancing tonight. It don't matter which one gets a hold of me or I get a hold of them, you know.
That's Hoot Gibson. I met him at Arky Blue's Silver Dollar in Bandera, Texas. He's just one of many characters you'll hear from in Vanishing Postcards, a podcast where we explore the hidden dives, traditions, and frequently threatened histories discovered by exiting the highways.
We don't give a flying flip for most of your regular bar types.
Featuring dispatches from the back roads, Vanishing Postcards is a touching, frequently humorous experience, perfect for when you need a breather, but don't have the time or luxury of jumping in the car. I'm Evan Stern, and I invite you to join this ride by finding Vanishing Postcards wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Last episode on part 4 of Justice for Carla, you heard Cindy Walker Stone's allocation in its entirety, and you heard Jim Walker talk about his. There was a common theme in these two impact statements. Both Cindy and Jim urged their sister Carla's killer, Glenn Samuel McCurley, to come clean about any other heinous crimes he's responsible for.
There's DNA on any of these other ones because obviously he wasn't very safe. I think they could solve some more.
Certainly, Jim and Cindy weren't simply pleading with the man to confess to other crimes carelessly or without reason. Tarrant County Assistant Criminal District Attorney Emily Dixon told us that McCurley's attack against Carla Walker and Rodney McCoy didn't seem like the work of a novice.
It is fairly sophisticated. It's pretty brazen. Normally, I would think most people who are going to try and snatch someone would not go for someone who's with someone else. Whether or not they're, you know, just two teenagers, it's very bold to go and do that. And it's also bold to walk up to someone who is inside a car. You're just adding another variable on top of it, right? And so that's also very brazen.
Glenn McCurley approached a strange car with a gun and badly bludgeoned Rodney McCoy in the head. He aimed a .22 caliber Ruger pistol at Rodney's face and pulled the trigger 3 times before bludgeoning him more. If the gun had fired, it's likely that Rodney, too, would have been killed. McCurley put Carla in his car and at some point raped and strangled her to death. This attack was bold and confident. It seemed like the work of someone who's done it before. Though I know of no evidence solidly linking McCurley to other area rapes or murders, there has certainly been speculation since his arrest.
There's too many unsolved cases that we're all aware of that are too similar.
Since there are around 1,000 cold cases in the city of Fort Worth dating back to 1959, there are plenty of victims that could have died by McCurley's hands. However, there might be a reason to isolate a few, as far as McCurley's concerned. Last episode, Jim Walker stated that he hoped one thing he said in his allocation came through loud and clear, that the evening McCurley began hunting for a victim, February 16, 1974, was the man's 11th wedding anniversary. In Fort Worth, a series of unimaginably violent slayings took place in the same month over the course of many years. Believing them to be connected, the press dubbed these crimes the February slayings. By February of 1973, Becky Martin and her husband David had been married 4 years and had a 2-year-old girl, Carrie. Becky was a waitress at Kipp's Big Boy near the campus of Texas Christian University. She was also taking night classes at Tarrant County Junior College, now Tarrant County Community College. Wednesday, February 7th, 1973, was a particularly hectic day for Becky and David Martin. Both had to juggle work, moving to their new house in the Everman neighborhood, and caring for their girl, who had come down with the flu. Because little Carrie was ill, Becky had been forced to skip school the previous Monday night, but she couldn't afford to miss Wednesday night's exam in English class. There was a lot on the couple's plate that day, and to top it off, a weather front had brought with it cold rain and crisp southerly winds. Early that evening, Becky Martin left for Tarrant County Junior College, or TCJC. According to a classmate, Becky completed her English exam a little early and left class around 8:30 p.m. When we spoke to David Martin back in 2017, he told us he was anxious when Becky did not return home promptly after class. By 10 p.m., he became worried she was having problems with the car and decided to bundle up little Carrie and head up to campus in his truck, which was still loaded down with stuff from the move. Row by row, David Martin drove the parking lot at TCJC until he finally found his wife's car, the driver's side door, ajar. Immediately, David was filled with intense dread. Muddy footprints and splatters covered the vehicle, and Becky's books and papers were strewn across the floor of the back seat as if there'd been a struggle. There were no keys inside, but using his own set, David discovered that the car wasn't inoperable. It started just fine. He immediately raced to the campus security office, and the guards there told David that they'd check it out. David hurried to his parents' house about 2 miles away. His little girl was burning up with fever, and he had to get her somewhere. Accompanied by his father, David headed back up to TCJC and called the police. By then, security had checked out the situation and assured David that Becky likely just got a ride home from someone else. That wasn't possible, David said, but after calling the Fort Worth police and waiting what seemed like an eternity for them to get there, they told him much of the same thing, or that Becky had just took off. David knew that was impossible. After Everman Police Chief Billy Tuttleman convinced them that something wasn't right, the Fort Worth police finally joined David Martin and the Everman police in looking for Becky. For a month, multiple jurisdictions, along with David, his family, and his friends, performed extensive searches. Becky was nowhere to be found.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Jim Mentor joined the investigation into 21-year-old Becky Martin's disappearance. Mentor told us in 2017 that, like the 1974 abduction and murder of Carla Walker, Becky's case has always stuck with him, well after retirement. In fact, he believes the two cases are connected. Of course, Jim Mentor didn't know the name Glenn Samuel McCurley until 2020, when he was identified and arrested for Carla's slaying. But the circumstances of Becky's disappearance certainly share a detail, a kidnapping from a vehicle. Like Carla Walker, Becky Martin was small. She stood 5'1" tall and weighed 100 pounds. Both murders, too, took place in the month of February. There's one more distinct similarity between the two cases. 7 weeks after Becky vanished, on Monday, March 26, 1973, at about 5:30 p.m., James Edward Anguish stopped his car near a culvert on Cattle Barren Road. The two-lane asphalt road is an extension of White Settlement Road. It's near the county line and mainly served dairy farms and a small housing development on the western edge of Tarrant County. James, his wife Maxine, and mother-in-law Ruby Little had been visiting R.J. Smelly's dairy farm just up the road, and since the ladies needed to relieve themselves, James stopped near a culvert so they could be beneath the road to do so, out of the range of sight for any passers-by that might come. When Maxine Anguish and Ruby Little made it to the mouth of the culvert, they discovered a decomposed body. They hurried back and told James what they'd seen. He went down the culvert to take a look, and it was immediately obvious that the remains were human. James, Maxine, and Ruby hurried back to the car and drove to the first house they came upon to call the police. Though Tarrant County Medical Examiner Dr. Felix Quotes first insisted that the remains belonged to an elderly woman, they were ultimately identified as those of Becky Whitaker Martin. A shoe, various debris, and a beer can were found near her body. Like Carla Walker, Becky's body was dumped in a culvert in a rural area in Tarrant County, outside Fort Worth city limits. Since Becky's remains were skeletonized, her cause of death is officially unknown. On her death certificate, trauma is listed, though it's specified that the determination is based on, quote, circumstances and history in the case. There were no knife or bullet marks found on Becky Martin's bones. Besides her killer kidnapping her from her car and dumping her body in a culvert, details of what happened to Becky Martin are largely unknown. No witnesses have come forward besides a Tarrant County Junior College student who reported a blue Ford Ranchero or Chevy El Camino slowly cruising the campus parking lot that night. It's not known if Becky was sexually assaulted, of course, and we know of no piece of evidence obtained in her case that has the potential for DNA testing. David Martin still awaits answers in the death of Becky, who he still refers to as his wife. A year later, in February of 1974, Carla Walker was abducted, beaten, raped, and murdered by Glenn Samuel McCurley. 3 years after that, there was another February slaying. In February of 1977, Cleburne resident and licensed vocational nurse June Mulder Ward was between gigs. June's marriage to her son David's father did not work out, and though she was enjoying being single and hanging out with her friends, she had been dating around some. But June was more concerned with raising David than she was with her love life. On the evening of Thursday, February 17, 1977, June dropped 8-year-old David off at the Cleburne YMCA for a boxing tournament before she headed to the Fort Worth area for a date. Early the following morning, a man named Gerald was chatting it up with two Fort Worth police officers, R.L. Murphy and F.L. Cummings, at Riviera's restaurant. At a little before 3 a.m., Gerald finished his cup of coffee and left the restaurant, only to promptly return at 3:04 a.m., startled and frantic. He told policemen Murphy and Cummings that while traveling down the 1000 block of West Fuller Street, he came upon the unclothed body of a woman. The officers followed Gerald to the scene, which was about 1.5 miles from Riviera's, and they all arrived within 2 minutes at 3:06 a.m. There, on the street next to the curb, the officers discovered the body of a woman, later identified as 25-year-old June Ward. Just minutes prior to the discovery of June's body, Fort Worth patrol officers had been dispatched to the service road of the 4800 block of South Freeway. A white 1973 two-door Chevrolet Laguna was blocking the thoroughfare. It was locked, and the police observed only a pair of woman's shoes and jumper cables in the vehicle on the backseat floorboard. The car had stalled, the responding officers figured, and the driver abandoned the vehicle as a result, likely unable to move it by themselves. This was not an unusual occurrence, necessarily, and the cops thought little about it. The car was later determined to belong to June Ward. At 3:30 a.m., homicide detective Daryl Thompson and crime scene officers G.L. Nichols and Steve Noonkester arrived at the scene where June's body was found. Deep gashes were observed in June's head. She had sustained blows from a sharp, heavy object, later theorized to be a hatchet or carpenter's hammer. However, these injuries were post-mortem. June had been strangled to death. It was later determined at an autopsy performed by Dr. Felix Quotes. In fact, her bra strap was still tightly around her neck when she was found. The wounds to June's head caused by a sharp, heavy object are certainly in contrast to the murders of both Carla Walker and Becky Martin. However, June put up a great struggle. The fingers on her right hand were all broken. Perhaps the head injuries were inflicted post-mortem as the result of the perpetrator's anger. Similarities between June Ward's extremely violent slaying and the previous February slayings end with the month it occurred, her cause of death, strangulation, and the woman's size. June was small, like Becky and Carla, standing only 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighing about 120 pounds. Since there appeared to have been no struggle in or around June's vehicle, it seems more likely she accepted a ride from the wrong person after becoming stranded, rather than being abducted from the car. June's son, David, has been in search of answers for over four decades. His sister, Jenna, was born a couple years after his birth, but because June was so young and struggling to care for one child, she decided that her daughter would have a better life with those who were better equipped to provide for her, and Jenna was adopted by another family. She only learned about June's terrible murder as a young adult when David finally met her. Evidence in both Becky Martin and June Ward's cases, from what I understand, is scant. Although Tarrant County Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Felix Quotes determined that there was no direct indication that June had been sexually assaulted, that was always the doctor's go-to answer for the press to suggest that there was a sexual assault motivation of some kind. We were told by a man named John Underwood, a crime scene investigator at the Monroe County Sheriff's Office in Florida and a classmate of June's from elementary school to high school, that semen was found on June's body. But the technology available when the case was reopened back in 2011, apparently, could only produce a partial profile. Considering the stringent requirements for uploading a DNA profile into FBI's Combined DNA Indexing System, or CODIS, it's unlikely the partial profile taken from evidence in June Ward's murder case has been uploaded there. 6 years after the brutal murder of June Ward, there was another victim in the so-called February slangs, Christy Jean Tower.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Originally from London, Ontario, Canada, Christy Jean Tower had moved to Odessa, Texas in 1980 for a little warmth and for a little soul searching. After moving in with her big sister Wendy in Grand Prairie in December of 1982, 26-year-old Christy scored a job waiting tables at the world's biggest honky-tonk, Billy Bob's in Fort Worth. The nightclub was a perfect job for the young woman. Not only were good tips all but guaranteed, the late hours also were right up the night owl's alley. When she clocked in for her shift on the evening of Thursday, February 3rd, 1983, Christy had been working for Billy Bob's for about 3 weeks. Besides some creep harassing all the waitresses, the night went off without a hitch. Just a normal shift listening to loud, drunk cowboys, and of course, the all-hat, no-cattle types. After she clocked out at about 2:30 a.m., now the early morning hours of Friday, February 4th, 1983, Christy headed to her 1975 copper-colored Chevy Impala. Christy was last seen by a fellow Billy Bob's employee who witnessed a man approach her and begin arguing with her. The same man who'd been harassing waitresses all night. After that, Christy Tower vanished. Almost 3 months later, on Wednesday, April 20th, 1983, a landscaping company cleanup crew was removing trash and other debris from a field on the 3100 block of Fossil Creek Boulevard. There, they came upon the badly decomposed body of a woman lying face down, partially covered by rocks and various other debris. This body was later identified as Christy Jean Tower. Her hands were bound behind her back with electrical wire, and another wire was twisted around her neck. Neither the medical examiner nor the Fort Worth police disclosed whether or not Christy had been raped. Though the witness provided a description of the man she saw arguing with Christy and a composite sketch was made, it wasn't released until over a month after she disappeared. The man was described as standing 6 feet 3 inches tall and weighing somewhere around 235 pounds. He had blonde, unkempt hair, blue eyes, and a beard. Though the hair and eyes don't match Glenn Samuel McCurley, necessarily, the height and weight is spot on. And when considering another logistical circumstance, Carla Walker's killer seems like a good suspect for Christie's murder. See, while Christie was missing, a couple was arrested after they found her purse and attempted to buy items and get cash using her checkbook. This couple didn't take the purse from Christie Tower. Rather, one of them found it in the dumpster of a bar called Cheers off Camp Bowie Boulevard while collecting aluminum cans for recycling. So, Christie's purse was found discarded in the dumpster of a bar in West Fort Worth, about 20 miles from the North Fort Worth location her body was found. 20 miles away, if you took the easiest, most inconspicuous route, Loop 820 to Interstate 30 to U.S. Route 183. And, in fact, if you killed Christie Tower and lived on a street called Mark's Place, you'd pass the bar Cheers and perhaps choose to discard any evidence you took from the scene there. Glenn Samuel McCurley, in fact, lived on Mark's Place in 1983 and continued to until his arrest for the murder of Carla Walker in September of 2020. Christie Tower, like Carla, was blonde. She was also small, at 5 feet, 4 inches tall, and 115 pounds. 3 years later, another slaying in the month of February. At about 7:30 a.m. on Monday, February 24th, 1986, the body of a woman unidentified to this day was found on the 1300 block of Kuroki Street near Hillside Park in Fort Worth. The woman is estimated to have been in her late 30s and would have stood 5 feet 3 inches tall and weighed about 120 pounds. She was nude and died as the result of asphyxiation by strangulation. Little else was ever reported about this woman, who we'll call Hillside Jane Doe. But perhaps only concentrating on McCurley's potential involvement in these February slayings is short-sighted. On Friday, April 28, 1978, a 48-year-old man taking a walk in a heavily wooded area near John T. White Road in East Fort Worth discovered the body of a female. This woman's blouse was the only clothing still on her body, but it had been torn and pulled over her head. The body was later identified as Hearst resident Paula Jean Puckett Davenport, who, like Carla, was last seen at a bowling alley. That was a few days earlier, on April 25th. In Paula's case, though, it was the Brunswick Bowler Land on Fort Worth's East Lancaster Avenue, quite a distance away from the Ridgely Brunswick Bowling Alley where Carla was abducted. It was discovered at autopsy that Paula Jean Davenport had been shot to death in the chest with a .22 caliber firearm, and though Tarrant County Medical Examiner Dr. Felix Quotes was unable to determine definitively if Paula had been raped, he remarked that by all indications, her killer either did sexually assault her or at least attempted to sexually assault her. Glenn McCurley, as we now know, kept his prized .22 caliber Ruger pistol all these years, and contrary to the Hollywood version of them, serial killers often change their methods of operation, their murder weapons. Early in the morning on Tuesday, May 12, 1981, a passerby discovered the body of 22-year-old Nancy Lynn Bay on a dead-end road on the east side of Lake Como in West Fort Worth, about 50 feet from the water's edge. Nancy was only partially clothed and almost certainly sexually assaulted. Like Paula Davenport, Nancy Bay was shot in the chest with a small caliber bullet, though in Nancy's case, the exact caliber was not specified in reports. From what I understand, Nancy was last seen leaving her place of employment, the Tempo Club, much like Christie Tower would be 2 years later, but in her case, it was another nightclub, Billy Bob's. It's unknown what evidence remains from Nancy Bay, Paula Davenport, or Christie Tower's cases. several days after McCurley changed his plea to guilty mid-trial and his subsequent sentencing, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram published an article written by Kaylee Johnson. In this piece, Kaylee spoke with Department of Criminology at the University of South Florida associate professor and former FBI special agent, Dr. Brianna Fox. Dr. Fox told the newspaper that most people who commit murder know their victims and only kill once, meaning that murders as the result of rage, passion, or some sort of financial gain, to name a few examples, by folks who know their victims, are the most common types. Stranger murder, Dr. Fox said, can possibly indicate that they are satisfying an urge, and that urge comes back. Glenn Samuel McCurley didn't know Carla Walker at all. The fact that McCurley was motivated by rape, added University Chair of Criminology at Texas State University, Kim Rosmo, makes the chances of prior and or repeat offenses good odds. Dr. Fox also explained to the Star-Telegram that strangulation as the method of killing is uncommon in stranger crimes. Strangling someone to death is not an easy thing to do, and it's not necessarily quick. This method, too, by a stranger, suggests an urge, a depraved motive rooted deep in the killer's psyche. But these aren't the only reasons to suspect that Glenn Samuel McCurley has struck before and after he raped and murdered Carla. The language the man can be heard using in both the audio of Detectives Wagner and Bennett visiting him to obtain a cheek swab for DNA comparison and in the videoed police confession are telling. He called Carla the little girl who got captured. Captured is a word that seemingly only a predator would use when describing a kidnapping and murder victim. McCurley also told detectives during his confession that he had consensual sex with Carla. She was compliant, the killer said.
That word compliant is just so really disturbing to me. I mean, it's so accurate, probably, but not in the way he's trying to make it, right? I mean, she's being held at gunpoint. So to some extent, she's compliant because she has a gun pulled on her. And she's being taken away from the car. I mean, when we think about Rodney's wording of what he experienced, he describes this very graphic scene of there's blood pouring down into his eyes. I mean, that's what she's seeing as she's being led away. In that moment, he seemed to truly believe that was okay. That, well, I mean, she was compliant. So what's your problem with this, right?
As both Cindy and Jim locked eyes with Glenn Samuel McCurley during their allocations, the man sat stone cold and silent, his eyes and cheeks dry. The man offered no emotion, no sobbing, not even a whimper, nothing whatsoever during these incredibly impactful statements. It is unimaginable to me that someone who felt remorse for abducting, raping, and murdering an innocent 17-year-old girl could have listened to the powerful words of Carla's siblings without shedding so much as a tear. It's telling, damning. Also seemingly damning is Glenn McCurley's recollections during his videoed police interview. One time, he tells Detectives Wagner and Bennett that he left Carla next to some bushes, and another time, next to a building. Perhaps it is not careless or even overzealous to suspect that the killer is mixing up his victims. During its playback at trial, several parts of McCurley's interview were taken out, and it's a safe bet that it's because these parts contained potentially important clues about other cases that can't be made public. Whether or not Glenn Samuel McCurley is responsible for one or all of these murders, technologies in DNA science, genetic genealogy, and a renewed public interest in solving cold cases is catching up to the bad guys.
I hope somebody's listening to this one day, and if he's a bad guy meaning he's killed somebody, done horrific things, I hope this sends chills because I'm talking to you. Hope this sends chills down your spine. You might be sitting at home drinking a beer, eating a pizza, Your kids are asleep, your wife's asleep. It should send chills down your spine because your time is up. It's coming. You just need to know you're on the radar. It's not if, it's when, and we are coming for you.
Like we said last episode, and it cannot be reiterated enough, Carla Walker's legacy is no longer shrouded by uncertainty and a faceless, nameless boogeyman. Instead, her case has become a template for solving long unsolved crimes.
If it hadn't been for that new technology, we would not be here today. I mean, it did it. It really is amazing, and I just hope this will solve so many other cases. The funding, I hope these labs and stuff can get some state funding and or whatever it will take so they can keep doing it. I think criminals, they need to be watching out, is what I've got to say.
Here's Othram Incorporated CEO David Middleman.
That's why you need this technology. I mean, of course you can find a case where people didn't care and didn't do the work necessary. I'm sure that case exists. But most of these cold cases, when we look at these cold cases, there's been decades of effort on them. It's not like people didn't try. There's been tremendous effort on these cases. You know, when we work a case involving an unidentified person, the families have almost always reported the person missing. Like, people have done what they can do. And if there was a plausible way to chase down a lead, you know, in most cases, it would have been chased. And so when you have a case like Carla Walker's case, you know, and it's been decades, and there's just literally no more leads to chase, that's not for lack of trying. That's just because, as we found out at the end, the case just didn't make sense. Someone was just randomly somewhere, and you wouldn't have any way to draw the connection unless you had DNA, or unless, for example, Rodney had been able to see the person's face and describe them to a sketch artist, but he was knocked out after being beaten with the bottom of the gun. So, you know, there was no plausible leads. And unfortunately, there's so many cases that are like this. There are cases where there's just no obvious relationship between the victim and the perpetrator, or you have like an unidentified person, unidentified victim, and there's just like some huge disparity, some huge difference between, you know, when they were reported missing and when they were found, or where they were missing and where they were found. Something really wild that just like disconnects the case, and it takes DNA to basically reconnect the two pieces together and complete the investigation. The legacy isn't just hope for other families that have had, you know, family members be the victim of a crime, but the legacy is also the beginning of a path to use this technology more formally in a courtroom to help drive a successful prosecution of a case. And that's important because the adoption of the technology is contingent largely on showing that it can do something useful and that it also won't get, you know, totally trashed in court. Right? Like it's not just solve the case at all costs. It's solve it in a way that you can prosecute it and bring the right folks to justice.
Perhaps the easiest way for a layperson to get on board helping solve these many cold cases in our state and in the United States and beyond is by going to DNASolves.com.
It is. And you know, a lot of these cases don't have funding. And so that's honestly the, you know, Othram is we're Othram, but we also have, as you know, the DNA Solves, you know, portal, the DNASolves.com portal. And we use that, as you noticed, to highlight cases generally that are very, very, very unknown. Cases that I just don't think don't have nearly enough attention shown to them. And so one problem is no one knows about them. And you never know. Sometimes just talking about a case can generate a lead. But in addition to not being well discussed, and so we don't know if there's any leads that might help solve them, they don't have any obvious funding source. And so these cases just sit. And so we try to go after some of these cases that are both old, but also not well known and not easily fundable, and get those worked in as well. Because, you know, ideally in a perfect world, every case would be given that attention and the technology would be applied to it, and we try to get answers. But it's obviously so many cases out there and only so much time and resources and so on. If you contribute your DNA, and I have to say, if you have DNA profile already from a consumer DNA company, you can just upload that. It's very quick. You just upload it to DNA Solves. For people that want to help that have never tested with a consumer company, we developed a cost-effective way. which I think we discussed for the first time on your podcast, believe it or not, a year ago. So long before we had actually launched it. But yeah, we built a way for folks to contribute their profile. They want to volunteer to basically a registry that we've built. We have this program. You can get to it at connect.dnasolves.com, and we'll send you a kit. You can volunteer a DNA profile that way. And the more profiles we have, the easier it is for us to essentially anchor these unknown folks onto family trees and work back and figure out who they are. And so whether we're trying to identify a victim that's never been named, or a perpetrator, as in Carla's case, every person can help. And so, you know, we don't push it hard, but, you know, I don't want to make someone do something they want to do. But for those that want to participate, whether to share their DNA, whether to help, you know, throw a couple bucks at funding a case, or even just to share on social media and get the word out in case someone knows something, we encourage people that want to get involved in any capacity to come to DNASolves.com and check out what we're doing.
We'll provide links to DNASolves.com in this episode's show notes. There will be another way you can help local to Fort Worth soon, and we'll let y'all know as soon as we can. And that's it for our coverage of Carla Walker. Her case is solved. To quote Jim Walker, finally, finally, justice for Carla.
I don't think there's anything that accidentally happened. We might not know why something happened, but see, I thank God for you. I thank God for the ladies, and you know who I'm talking about. I thank God for, I mean, I could just go down the list, because there were lots of times where I would just think it's over, it's done, we're never going to know. And God kept putting people on my path, like you, that reinvigorated me, you know, gave me hope. Here's somebody I never knew until this event transpired has become a close personal friend. He and his beautiful wife, close personal friend of me and the Walkers, encouraged. I just kept, God just kept saying to me, do you trust me? I'm giving you signs. Yes, Lord, I trust you 100%. And I'm so thankful that you came into our life, you come into Carla's life, and that you've done what you've done. That I will tell you, there's many times, you know, dark times, wondering, you know, I just don't see it, Lord. I mean, nothing. But then things changed about, really for me, about 5 years ago. And I'd met you before that. And that's the army I'm talking about. And I'm so glad you didn't give up. I'm so glad what you and the podcast did. They're good men, there's good women, who knows why they're doing stuff, but they're doing stuff. And I think absolutely it comes down to the fact that there's more good people than there are bad people. Don't piss off the good people, because we're not going to let it go. We're going to get you. I've got chills right now just thinking about the army that McCurley caused to rise.
If you have any information about the 1973 murder of Becky Martin, the 1977 murder of June Ward, the 1978 murder of Paula Davenport, the 1981 murder of Nancy Bay, the 1983 murder of Christy Tower, or the 1986 slang of Hillside Jane Doe, or her true identity, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307, or by emailing detectives at coldcase@fortworthpd.com. We've covered all these cases in the past, with the exception of Nancy Bay, and you can find them all on our feed. We'd like to thank Cindy, Jim, Tarrant County ADA Emily Dixon, and David Middleman for their contributions to this episode. Thanks also to all Carla's friends and classmates, and to our listeners who've kept her memory alive and sought justice for her. Y'all are the best. Thank you. As always, you can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as Fort Worth 1974 Parts 1 and 2 and the House of Horrors. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. We appreciate it beyond words. Thanks for listening, y'all.